Well, certainly over here, the news that has been the most prominent has been the bombing in London, and it has caused quite a bit of comment one way or another. And what I'd like to do today is something a little bit more unusual, because there's two of the comments that I've heard, which I think are quite valuable to listen to, were not actually newspaper comments at all. They were comments on the BBC. There were clips. One was from the Sunday programme, and the other one was actually from the news this morning, or the Today programme this morning. And I think that I'd like to go ahead and play those two clips or segments of it for you, so you can actually hear them. But I have mentioned before how when we're looking in somewhere like Luke 21, well, Luke 21 particularly, we don't have to turn there, but it talks about not premeditating how to answer when you've taken before the courts. And it seems to flow into the abomination that makes desolate, or the Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. Now, if we turn over to Revelation 12, it becomes quite clearly, because what I have pointed out is this seems to be talking to us now rather than at that time back then. It's almost like a double layer, one layer on top of another. One was for 71 AD and the other one is for the end time, and the two almost merge together. But here, when we're looking at Revelation chapter 12, if we look down in verse 12, it says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea," and about halfway through, "for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." Mr. Armstrong did tend to feel that that happened in the late 70s, when the Attorney General and the problems that they're having then. And if we look subsequently what's happened to the church, certainly there has been a shattering such as we've never seen before, and the speed at which that shattering took place. And it says, "And when the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman that which brought forth the man-child. And the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she may fly to the wilderness to a place where she's nourished for a time, times and a half a time, from the face of the serpent." Now, I've heard some people say to me, and they say that, well, this particular verse in verse 13 is referring to the persecution on the church, which has taken place because it's been Protestantized by Satan, quite frankly. And we are now shattered. And then the next thing to happen is that the church flees. But I wonder if that is sufficient, if that is the only persecution that is actually implemented, or indicated, rather, in these verses. And I think the clincher is in verse 15, where it says, "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman." And if you check in Revelation 17:15, you find that it talks about water being the peoples and languages and tongues. So here is an army of people that are coming after the woman. "Cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he may cause her to be carried away of the flood." So the persecution goes right until the time that she's actually fleeing. And it says, "And the earth helped the woman, the earth opened her mouth and swallowed the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth." So we're looking here at the earth, if you like, swallowing or opening its mouth. And the only place you're going to find that mentioned, that event mentioned, is over in Numbers 8:16. You don't have to turn there, put it down in your notes. But Numbers 16, which talks about Korah and how the earth opened the mouth and swallowed them. And something along those lines seems to be indicated by these verses. And it certainly does indicate that the persecution is going to last right until the church flees, and is going to be instrumental in the church fleeing to some degree, because the flood will come after the woman as the church is actually fleeing. Now, what I think I'd like to do now is, if we can try and play one of the snippets that I've got. And it's really, and before I do though, if I just give a little bit of indication as to what you need to be listening to, because it's talking about the recent bombings, and it was from the Sunday program. It's actually a man, it's introduced by the presenter, but there's a man called Oliver McTurnan. Now, I want you to notice that he is in fact a Catholic, or the Catholic, terror expert. Now, if you notice what is being said here, it talks about how he's written this book, Violence in God's Name, how he formerly ran a Catholic parish in London, so he's actually involved with the Catholic Church. And there are 3 points I want you to notice. First of all, that he's saying that it's not an Islamic problem. So it's indicating there are other things besides Islam that's being talked about. Secondly, it's a rejection of Western values. which again has a great deal of to say regarding the church. And thirdly, how very persuasive arguments and how convicted these people are. And how, you know, you've got to be very careful with this. So I thought I'd just, we'd just play that one from Oliver McTernan.
Now we return to the question which we've all been asking in the past few days. What makes someone blow himself up and kill anyone in the vicinity, be they man, woman or child, Christian, Jew or Muslim? I'm now joined by Dr. Zaki Badawi and by Oliver McTernan, who formerly ran a Catholic parish in London and is the author of Violence in God's Name, Religion in an Age of Conflict.
It's not an exclusive Islamic problem. I mean, we can find examples of religious people involved in wanting to change the political course of events because of their profound beliefs. It's the framework in which they work. Now, I think what we've got to recognize that and address it if we're going to deal with this current crisis.
Do you think, just on that point, do you think that what these people want is, in a sense, undeliverable? It's not as if they want just specifically BRICS out and Americans out of Iraq. It's not that specifically they want Israel perhaps not to exist or whatever. It is a rejection of the totality of Western life and a wanting a return to a situation that they think obtained, say, 1,000 years ago.
I would certainly agree with that, Roger, because I think basically it's people who reject the current values, and especially the values of the Western world, and believe that you can recreate a society, a global situation that is in keeping with the fundamental values and beliefs of their particular tradition. When I was in Boston, looking at these issues, I recall talking with the prosecutors of Richard Reed, and in fact they were...
That was the shoe bomber who was caught on the plane.
And two public prosecutors had been appointed to defend him, and they said, can we come and talk to you, because we are just moved by this young man's convictions. It's totally contrary to what we are dealing with in our normal course of things, of murder and everything else. And they were profoundly moved by his understanding, albeit, and I agree with Saki, a misguided understanding of his faith tradition, but he profoundly believed in it, so much so that they were worried about how it was impacting on them.
Well, I thought that would be interesting for you to actually listen to, because I found it quite fascinating, and they had to actually cut the interview at that point. They'd run out of time, so the interview was cut. But do notice that he's saying that it's not an Islamic problem, it's a rejection of Western values which is the problem. Notice, if there's anybody that rejects Western values, it's us. And it also has very persuasive arguments, to the point of almost persuading the people that are actually interviewing the shoe bomber in that case. It says here, an extremist cleric put terror laws to the test. It says, a planned visit to Britain next month by a Muslim cleric who has praised suicide bombings against Israel will become the first test of the government's promised clampdown on extremist preachers after the London terrorist attack. Now, Yusuf al-Qadari, 79, who is due to speak at a conference in Manchester, was banned from visiting America because of his link with the fundamentalist Muslim Brotherhood. And he says, last Friday, the Home Office outlined proposals aimed at restraining militants by making it a crime to glorify or condone terrorism. The minister said that it would cover statements suggesting that suicide bombers were martyrs. Now, that strikes at the very fundamentals of their beliefs in that sense. Although Qadari's supporters said that he had condemned the tube and bus attacks, he praised suicide bombing against Israel, and it goes on in that particular article. There's another one here, the men who blame Britain. It says, critics of Tony Blair's policy in Iraq and Afghanistan claimed yesterday that Britain must share some of the responsibility of the underground and bus bombings in London. And it goes on, it says, radical Muslims who did not take part in the talk said that they would not be silenced by warnings of the new legislation, making it a crime to glorify or condone terrorism. Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad said the support from America over Afghanistan and Iraq and the re-election of Mr. Blair had all contributed to the attacks. I blame the British government, the British public and the Muslim community in the UK because they failed to make the extra effort to put an end to the cycle of bloodshed which started before 9/11 and on June the 7th was devastating for everyone, he told the Evening Standard. It goes on. So, and there's another one here. This is Anjem Chaudhry, I think it is, the British leader of the militant Islamic group Al-Muhajiron, I think it is, said that the Muslim leaders should not meet Mr. Blair for talks while the Muslims were being murdered in Iraq. And speaking on Radio 4's Today program, he declined to condemn the London bombings, which killed 56 people, and said there's a very real possibility of a repetition, and the British government wants to show that they're on the side of justice and truth, whereas in reality the real terrorists are the British regime, and even the British police, and so on it goes. So these are the kind of statements that are being made, but you see, what is happening is that the reaction cannot be seen to be anti-Islam. It's got to be even-handed. And what we see, therefore, is this other one. It says, Western Islamic world must unite to beat the terrorist scourge. It says, an alliance of Islamic and Western countries to combat the scourge of terrorism was proposed by the Spanish Prime Minister during talks with Tony Blair yesterday. Now remember, from Spain came the Spanish Inquisition. And the Spanish Inquisition was a means of suppressing the Jews, or suppressing anybody that was basically against the Catholic Church. Mr. Blair said that he could see potential for the proposals for an alliance of civilizations to prevent terrorists dividing people and nations by race or religion. And he said, Jose Zapatero, who was elected after the Madrid train bombings last year, has suggested a coalition of civilized people from whatever race or religion to combat the barbarity of terrorism. Now, what that then justifies is what this article that Ian actually sent me from the Times, and the subject is your privacy, and the kind of little sub-quote was, evening all, name, address, DNA sample, and so on. So, in other words, it's not just a case of your name and address, but in fact, it goes much beyond that. It says, let me just read this part of this article. I'll place a bet here and now that within 2 years, tens of thousands of British motorists will have been arrested, fingerprinted, DNA tested, and drug tested for minor road and traffic violations. Some for turning the wrong way at an intersection, some for thoughtlessly driving in a bus lane, or speeding on the motorway, or whatever it happens to be. The experience will be traumatic but efficient, because fingerprints will be scanned at the roadside, transmitted instantly for checking against the National Fingerprint Database, and while this information is being processed, a sample of saliva or hair will be taken. Once the government has introduced mandatory drug testing, as it's pledged, a roadside drug test can determine instantly whether a range of substances are present in the body. And the DNA can be also analysed. Meanwhile, the usual checks will be made against the police national computer and intelligence databases, and with the establishment of corporate data models across the entire law enforcement community, police can also access information from the probation service and courts, and forthcoming new provisions for information sharing will also empower the police to reach into databases throughout governments that are currently inaccessible. And it goes on then, and it says the data search will not be confined to the UK. The PNC is compatible with Europe's SIS, or Schengen Information System, sounds like German, designed to exchange criminal and wanted person information across Europe. SIS is expanding to include four new categories of people: violent troublemakers, such as protesters and suspected football hooligans, people whose visas have expired, who would be subject to arrest and expulsion, an EU visa database to record all visa applications issued and refused, and a database of all third country nationals legally resident in the EU, which is more than 14 million people. Traffic violations are currently dealt with through summons rather than arrest. However, a raft of new laws and amendments to the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, the Criminal Justice Act, and the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act has created police powers that will be unthinkable in most democracies. The trigger for many of these new powers is Clause 106 of the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act, hastily passed into law just before the election. The section removes the traditional legal distinction between, quote, arrestable offence, and an arrestable offence is an offence which is punishable by imprisonment, and an ordinary offence, things like littering, jaywalking, blowing a whistle in an annoying manner, and that kind of thing. So you can go ahead and have your fingerprints taken and your DNA samples taken and put into a database forever and a day for these minor infractions, which are not criminal in any way, shape or form. Once this section comes into force after the summer, any officer can use the full powers of arrest and all the bells and whistles that go with it to deal with any transgression, no matter how trivial. Recent legislation empowers police to take fingerprints and DNA samples on arrest, rather than upon charge. The data will remain indefinitely on police systems, even if the subject is acquitted. Now, that is not a mere oversight. You don't have a mere oversight. Oh, we just didn't quite get the legislation right. That is deliberate. It is a deliberate means of trying to bring this kind of thing in by the back door, and it is causing some real difficulties and real problems, or has the potential to cause some real problems. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to play the next one, which is an interview with somebody who is from France, who is an official in France, regarding the Ministry of Defence, I think it is over there, regarding the difference between the English and the French systems. And I want you to notice what the difference actually is.
The French have always insisted, of course, that they will not tolerate radical Muslim preachers. Is there anything we can learn from the French experience? I spoke earlier to Dr. Alexis Debat, a former advisor to the French Ministry of Defence.
If the French are excellent, very good, they're very good at intelligence, at internal security, that is the main reason why France has had its terrorist groups much more in control than the Brits, because we have tools that the British government does not have.
Well, tell me about those tools.
We have a police unit called the Renseignement Général, General Intelligence. It's about 4,000 police officers whose mission is to spy on any organized group, labor unions, political parties, mosques, churches, places, I mean, any place of worship, any kind of organized group they're going to spy on. I mean, it's extremely powerful. It's a political police. I mean, let's just name it as it is.
Does everybody know that they're being spied upon like this?
They usually don't, because these people are very, very good. I mean, you're talking about a service that more or less was born, you know, about 200 or 300 years ago. I mean, we have a culture of internal security in France that there isn't in Great Britain. And we do it very well. I mean, it's almost like a KGB. So on the other hand, it's extremely efficient for things like counterterrorism, for example.
Well, I think that gives a kind of flavour to the difference between the UK and the actual continent. And remember where these things came from. They came from 300 years ago. Now, you go back 300 years and you find, you know, you're looking at the French Revolution at that time. And there is this, like the Spanish Inquisition. You're coming from a similar kind of, the inquisitorial form of justice is what we have on the continent. Now, what I would like to do, just to wrap this up, is just to mention one thing that you need to understand. If there is something that separates us from these terrorists, there is one word that describes it, and that is premillenarianism. Now, you've probably never heard of premillenarianism, but it's a word that I suggest you memorize, or premillennialism. Because what in fact it is, what that describes, is a theological term, and it describes what we believe. We are premillenarianist. Now, we know what millenarian or millennium means. All of us know that within the church. But what's the pre-bit? Well, the pre-bit refers to when Christ will actually arrive, when Christ will return. And you've got premillenarianist, you've got antimillenarianist, and you've got amillenarianist. And the amillenarians don't believe in the millennium, quite frankly. But you've got both before and after. You've got the view where you return before or return after. Now, if you've got to establish the kingdom of God on earth now, then you've got to, you can go out, you can bomb, you can do whatever you feel you need to do to go ahead and do that. But we're not of that persuasion. That is not the way that the Bible explains. If you turn over to Revelation, and just a couple of scriptures in closing here. In Revelation 19, it's worth you a while just to keep this in mind. Because in Revelation 19, here we see very clearly in verse 11, "And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness does he judge and make war." That's when the war will actually occur, when Christ returns. And it is done before the millennium. It's Christ who actually returns and implements this. And notice what it says here over in chapter 20, verse 4, it says, "And I saw thrones and those that sat upon them, and judgment was given to them." And it goes on, it says, "And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Notice, it is with Christ. So Christ has got to be here for that to take place. And it is, as long as we do understand that and keep this aspect in mind, it is somewhat of a defense. It's not entirely a defense, and I can guarantee you, are you looking at Revelation, the church is going to be persecuted, the church is going to be, a flood is going to be sent after the church. But it is very clear, that, and also another scripture you can put down, we don't have time to go into it, is John 18:36, that says, you know, my kingdom isn't of this world. If it were, then my servants would fight, but my kingdom is not from here. In other words, you've got to have Christ return first, premillenarianist. Christ returns first, and then the millennium comes. Then is the rule of the kingdom of God. That's what we believe firmly, and the holy days and everything else indicate that. So it is worth keeping that in mind, certainly as we hear and as we read the things that are currently happening in this area of terrorism. It is very significant. Don't in any way, shape or form think it's not significant. It is. And it is going to have, I believe, a great deal of bearing on the church itself. So we do need to be aware and be watching what's going on and making sure, however, that we understand that it's Christ who's going to have to return first before, you know, the all these nations, all these governments and everything else is actually put down. And that is our greatest defense in regard to anybody coming against us in this way.